Welcome to History Here and Now. I'm Thomas, the voice inside your podcast machine, and today is a great day to learn about history. The History Here and Now podcast is dedicated to bringing you great stories from the past. Here we talk about people, places, events, culture, and practically every other facet involved with history. Does it sound complicated? Well, history is just that, complicated, but it doesn't have to be. I'm here to help break things down and make history more fun, so let's get started. Today's episode, we're going to take a little more clandestine approach to today's topic. And today we're going to look at some of the very first operations carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency, or the CIA, based here in the United States. And we're going to also look at some of the early days of the CIA and some of their first operations and what was arguably one of the hardest lessons that the CIA had to learn in its early years of its life. Now, before we get started, I sort of want everyone to close their eyes and imagine this. You're a Korean refugee on an island in the Pacific Ocean. A shadowy American tells you that you're going to be trained to infiltrate communist-controlled Korea. Now, you've already heard about the North Koreans having rolled over, going down through the Korean Peninsula, and pushing back the American army that's already established there, and fighting their way towards the ocean, and civilians who have been had their homes destroyed. This is now something, this is an opportunity that you might want to take up. Technicians will teach you the basic survival skills, albeit through an interpreter since he can't speak Korean. They're going to assign you to codename teams such as White Tiger or Yellow Dragon. And then a short time later, you're going to be parachuting into the darkness over enemy territory. And if the briefing intelligence holds true, you can expect to lead guerrillas and resistance groups against the communist forces. But in reality, though, underlying this operation is basically a catastrophe waiting to happen. There has been falsified or misinformation, intelligence or reports. There's been poor preparation and training and equipping. There's been even administrative failures far outside your control. And all these things lead to your capture, interrogation, and likely your death. Now, the Central Intelligence Agency, who we'll just call CIA from this point on, they conducted numerous paramilitary operations on the Korean Peninsula during the Korean War, lasting from 1950 to 53. But the majority of these clandestine operations, they kind of all ended in failure. Now, we always hear about, these great, spy novels or films that we've seen about, the CIA being able to cleverly infiltrate into enemy territory or able to get people out of a, compromising situation or, the great battle of Cold War powers and how battles was done in the shadows between the CIA and the KGB, all competing for geopolitical superiority. But in reality, that's not how it all started. That didn't all start off, as action-packed as we may see. There were a lot of hard lessons that not just the CIA, but everyone had to learn. Now, contemporary analysts and modern historians do agree, though, that the CIA's first hot war, it was definitely not its finest hour. Now, the CIA was only 3 years old by the outbreak of the Korean War. The National Security Act of 1947 established the agency and the National Security Council, all with the goal of enhancing the United States' international security. With the eyes on the United States leading the post-war world, the CIA needed to quickly establish itself by building a reliable intelligence network in nations that relied on them during the Second World War, and needing to have a system of infiltration put in place for potential communist threats in the future. Now, sources inside North Korea and China were still severely limited, though. It was very difficult for agents to get into either of those areas, and much of the agency's personnel and financial resources were centered on Europe because they believed that that was the more imminent communist threat. You know, all of them had seen the intention that the Russian Soviet army had put coming from the Eastern Front, occupying territories as they were moving towards Berlin. They understood that this was going to be the next confrontation following the collapse of the Nazi regime. So, and this left areas of, you know, areas of like in Asia or Africa and South America, these were all very basically severely neglected areas by the CIA. So any high-level information coming from the Far East, though, was procured by a newly created president of the new Republic of Korea, President Syngman Rhee, or the King or the Chiang Kai-shek regime in nationalist China. But even at their best points, these were only marginally truthful. The CIA had to rely on a lot of old State Department files to give them additional information, although a lot of it was really outdated. Now, the lack of intelligence officers and sources in Korea left the United States perilously unprepared for the North Korean invasion. General Douglas MacArthur stonewalled the agency himself from conducting paramilitary operations, but the director of Central Intelligence, General Walter Bedell Smith, who himself being a decorated World War II general that served as General Eisenhower's chief of staff, they directed agents to provide tactical intelligence to the United Nations forces that would eventually intervene in the Korean conflict. A special group within the Office of Reports and Estimates focused solely on Korea as a way to increase the agency's analysis. Now, what followed, however, were a series of intelligence failures that embarrassed the agency. And by embarrassing the agency, basically sending out agents that never came back. In fact, they had trained hundreds of the CIA agents and trained guerrillas, just parachuting them into North Korea, saying, hey guys, here's everything you need, now go out and fight the enemy, and dropping the areas, and North Koreans more or less were just kind of picking them up as they parachuted to the ground. But we digress a little bit. The first was the agency's assessment of Chinese intervention. This was one of the first embarrassments or intelligence failures that the CIA had to deal with. In a dispatch to President Truman and General MacArthur's Wake Island Conference, the CIA argued that the Chinese would not attack the Korean Peninsula. Everything they had said that they were getting were saying that the Chinese would not intervene. It would be stupid of them for them to do that. It would not give them any sort of benefit. It was just not likely. But two sources inside the Tokyo station disagreed, though. They claimed that hundreds of thousands of enemy troops were poised across the Yalu River. Now, these reports were ignored because they were considered alarmist, and when the Chinese did launch their assaults in November of 1950, a lot of high-ranking people, including Director Smith, they were stunned. Having misread the enemy, the CIA needed to reprioritize its operations and intelligence analysis. And the analysis aspect was something that would still take many years for them to work out any kinks, because it required building a reliable network of information. Deputy Director of Plans, Alan Dulles, who himself would become a future Director of Central Intelligence, he and Smith quarreled over the effectiveness of covert missions. In declassified documents from 2002, Smith received vague circular answers from his deputies on the status of overseas operations. Now, this opaqueness resulted in unending frustration that plagued the CIA's role in the Korean War. Now, most paramilitary operations were described as not only ineffective, but probably morally reprehensible on the number of lives lost. One station chief based in Hong Kong, Peter Seichel, he was quoted as describing these efforts as suicidal and irresponsible. they were sent to supply non-existent or fictitious resistance groups. And of course, and as events on the battlefield transpired, the agency explored options in gathering solid intelligence and trying to insert moles inside the communist bloc. Now, why were they sending people to what they thought were fictitious, you know, resistance groups? Did they really believe that there was such an organized resistance inside North Korea? Well, and that is where the question comes in. Where were they getting their sources from? Was the information coming from someone actually in North Korea, or was it coming from a friend of a friend of a source of a friend? You know, we can go on and on and on. But I would personally think that a lot of this is coming strictly from hearsay, or it is also coming from the projection of those working in the CIA just simply not trusting the information that was coming in because they maybe thought they knew better. But this is just one of those aspects that could probably just be lost to history, and we just have to interpret it based on the evidence that we get. Now, going back to our story, have you ever heard the name of Frank Wisner? Well, if you really enjoy studying CIA history, his name should be one of the top 10 that you hear about, especially in the early days of the agency. Now, Frank Wisner, he was labeled the chief of covert operations. He was a giant in the early years of the CIA. He had already conducted numerous operations in Europe, and he would take a similar approach to Korea. You know, in fact, there's this urban legend that Wisner actually would hand out extra large size condoms to all of his agents based in Germany and other, you know, Western European nations to basically make the Russians feel inferior if CIA agents were ever caught. But I'm gonna say that's probably not true. But, you know, psychological warfare and all. Now, they were pitching millions of dollars to creating an agent training center in Saipan, because they would incorporate many of the same lessons and trainings taught by the Office of Strategic Services, or the OSS, which was basically the World War II predecessor to the CIA. They would take many of these same applications and use them during the Korean conflict. But the biggest problem, though, was just the lack of geographical, historical, and economic information that was available to the deployed officers. This Eurocentric focus, you know, really left the CIA at a disadvantage and giving them ill-suited preparation for Far Eastern scenarios. Now, Tim Weiner, a CIA historian, he writes that this deficiency had bloody consequences for the agency. He writes, quote, these men being CIA agents, were thrown into battle with little preparation or training. One among them was Donald Gregg, fresh out of Williams College. His first thought when the war broke out was, where the hell is Korea? Gregg took tough Korean farm boys, plucked them from refugee camps, brave but undisciplined men who spoke no English, and tried to turn them into instant American intelligence agents. The CIA sent them on crudely conceived missions that produced little save a lengthening roster of casualties. So, and this attitude wasn't just limited to, you know, just, you know, Donald Gregg, you know, in this quotation, but that was actually a real problem amongst those in the CIA and in higher levels of government itself. They were just not knowledgeable of the situation in Korea and China concerning the communists. Because, as I said, the Eurocentric focus, you know, everything, the Russians are going to invade Eastern, are going to invade, you know, West Germany. They're going to take over, you know, Czechoslovakia. They're going to try and, you know, turn Italy communist. You know, so everything was all focused there, and they were just, you know, and those who are standing in China and Korea and other places throughout Asia, they're screaming for help, but they're just not getting the resources. So the world of covert intelligence gathering and operations requires a high level of scrutiny to determine the accuracy of information. This was something we'd alluded to earlier. If you don't know, if you can't verify the information that's coming in, is it really something you want to hand off to your agents? Checking the validity of sources and having reliable contacts are pillars in making judgments for operations. Now in Korea, though, there were fabricated reports and outright lies were commonplace. Enterprising men who approached the agency officers with, quote, inside information, end quote, and I'm using that term generously, they were later revealed to have been con men trying to end themselves into the Ri regime or just the CIA payroll. Now, one notable example involving the fabricated intelligence deception occurred with the activities of three brigades under OSS veteran Hans Tofte. Between April 1951 and September 1952, thousands of Korean exiles were dropped into North Korea with missions to serve as intelligence gathering teams and carry out guerrilla warfare tactics, along with the added missions of rescuing American pilots. Hundreds of these exiles were captured and executed, but those who survived were sending back a flood of radio traffic detailing communist operations. Now, to the CIA station chief in Seoul, Albert Haney, these operatives were making progress by leaps and bounds, providing valuable intelligence that could change the course of the war. Now, many of these reports became almost too fantastic to believe, and Haney's successor, John Hart, thoroughly reviewed those reports. It was odd that despite having 200 officers in Seoul, there was no one who spoke Korean. Not a single person at the station, CIA station in Seoul, actually spoke Korean. And you kind of need to know the language if you're going to conduct covert operations in unfamiliar territory. Now, what Hart discovered was that nearly all the Korean operatives were actually feeding manufactured intelligence supplied by North Koreans and the Chinese. Another large portion were just simply outright lies with the operatives themselves. We're just totally, you know, liberated this one village, and yeah, we captured, you know, this North Korean, you know, soldier, and he confessed everything that this entire army is on the run, and yeah, we're the communists are on the run. Well, yeah, we're not really sure that's true. Now, this intelligence had already been passed up the chain of command, though, which was already not great. It was used as a foundation for covert military operations, but of course, if it's faulty from the start, everything else is just going to fall apart. The damage was done, it was irreparable, but how to emerge from this debacle without publicly tarnishing the CIA? The deputy director of intelligence, Loftus Becker, he was sent to Seoul to assess the station's ability to conduct uncompromising intelligence gathering. But he quickly concluded that the enemy penetration was too easy. No reliable reports could be generated, and it was evident to the CIA they would have to start over in Asia. No one was successfully able to infiltrate the North Korean regime. They were unable to get sufficient solid intelligence on Chinese operations. And basically, the agency was being deceived and lied to at almost every opportunity. Now, Frank Wisner, also the same CIA historian we referenced earlier, he had met with senior agency leaders, and he had written that, quote, "We are all aware that our operations in the Far East are far from what we would like. We simply have not had the time to develop the quantity and kind of people we must have it, or we are to successfully carry out the heavy burdens which have been placed on us." Now, that's a really prophetic statement, because that's an answer that you hear almost all the time when people ask, what do they know about it? How can we understand what is going on here so we can operate efficiently? And it's just that we don't have the time to develop the people we need. There is just too much in place, and we can't do it quickly. It takes time. And if you're in the espionage business, you'll know that a lot of the work is always reliant on time. If you have the time to turn someone into an informant or to a double agent, the more time you invest in them, the more likely you are to either find out if they're lying or if they're being genuine with their actions. Now, what directed many of the CIA's policies, of course, was its emphasis on Europe. Now, Asia itself was, like we said, considered a secondary theater that didn't pose any significant danger. Of course, this would change, you know, rapidly, decades later with the, and of course, interventions in Southeast Asia and Vietnam War. Future director Alan Dulles reinforces ideology following his promotion to director of Central Intelligence, which of course, and the subsequent intelligence failures in China and Indochina. The legacy of the Korean War for the CIA was one of recurring disappointment. The best that could be said was that Director Smith's restructuring of agency offices and command chain is that it's still used today. But there's still nothing that can salvage the cost of human lives that were lost trying to combat the communist regime during the Korean War. And in fact, there is one just perfect quote used by Tim Weiner, and he states simply that in terms of the Korean conflict and the CIA operatives that were active during that time, he ended it by saying, well, some people just had to get killed. Now, I'd like to make a quick note on the content of today's episode. This episode was inspired by one book that I had read last year called The Legacy of Ashes by the aforementioned historian Tim Weiner. It is one of the first detailed histories on the role and creation and the function of the Central Intelligence Agency, covering everything from its initial creation after World War II through the Cold War and including the War on Terror. If you're interested in learning more about CIA history, this is a great book to have on your bookshelf, called again, The Legacy of Ashes. Now, I really hope you enjoyed that story. History Here and Now is a website dedicated to the research and writing about different historical topics. If you like this podcast, hit the like button, share it on social media, recommend it to your friends, families, colleagues, and anyone you think would enjoy hearing a good history discussion. You can follow History Here and Now on Twitter and check back periodically for the next episode. Until then, good luck, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.